Today is October 16th, 2008, and I'm Sarah Molesky. As part of the Rock Voices Oral History Project, we have Dr. Theodore Wallach with us. How are you today?
Just fine, thank you.
Well, why don't we begin with you telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a native of Indiana, Terre Haute, Indiana, and I went to public schools there, but then I went to university in Indianapolis at Butler University. I went to Butler because I was a college debater and got a full-ride scholarship, actually, for debating, and that's why we went to Butler. And I had a lot of success there as a debater. We were national champions twice and that sort of thing. And then I got a National Defense Fellowship to study a Ph.D. at Ohio University. So I did a Ph.D. there and moved on from there to teach first at Hiram College in Ohio, and then at Butler in Indianapolis, then at Indiana State University in Terre Haute, and then I came here in 1971. My wife Barbara is also an academic. She's a certified nurse midwife, did her graduate work at Yale, and taught at West Virginia, and later we were married 30 years ago. She was teaching at Edinburgh at that time, and she retired in the late 80s. But we have two sons. My older son is a public school teacher in Mocksville, North Carolina. And the younger son is a Ph.D. in history and teaches now at a university in Morocco, of all places.
Wow.
But, he's had a number of international assignments.
That sounds like it'd be fun.
Yeah.
What's your affiliation with Slippery Rock University?
Well, I've been a member of the faculty since 1971. I came here to be the head of the, what was then the speech and theater department. I wanted to say department head because that was before APSCUF and the current contract and so forth. And department heads were appointed by the administration in those days. And then was chairman of the department pretty much steadily over a period of 20 years. Mm-hmm. I also had a number of other assignments. I was part of the interim administration of President Park and was director of planning for the university and had a title called Dean of Extended Services. I used to say that meant dean of et cetera. My portfolio got whatever else was going on. I spent some time on loan from the university to the state system to a unit called the Pennsylvania Educational Services Trust, which is another kind of long story, but where I helped develop faculty development programs for the system. And that was a kind of interesting two-year sort of hiatus I had.
Was that the retraining thing?
Yes, we did retraining, among other things. But, you know, we got into faculty. There was a time when there was retrenchment in the system, and there was a pot of money that came during the Nixon administration. There was a wage freeze, and APSCUF negotiated a kind of a irregular bargain that the money that the faculty would have been awarded in salary increases but couldn't get because of the wage freeze was paid into this trust fund, which was administered by a joint board of management and faculty. And I was on the board originally and then was hired and spent 2 years as the director of the trust, and we focused on faculty development in a number of ways, and it was interesting and kind of exciting stuff. We were really on the cutting edge and breaking some new ground, and we did other things as well. For example, we did a couple of what they called leadership academies for department chairs. And some of those kinds of things. But at any rate, that was a second of my assignments around here as or not around here, but on loan, really, from that. And I, all that time, I was sort of in and out of the department. And then late in my career, I became concerned that the university was not keeping up or was falling behind, in a sense, with the advent of instructional technologies and computers and all that kind of thing. So I convinced the provost, Chuck Faust at the time, that we needed to do something about that, and he gave me what amounted to a three-quarter time assignment, and we created something we called the Center for Learning Technology, and I did that for 3 years. Truth is, I didn't then and don't know now much about computers, really, but I knew that we needed to be energizing the place, so I spent a lot of energy and time trying to help faculty get involved with using instructional technology in the classroom. We created a couple of what now would be called smart classrooms in the World Culture Business building, the auditorium, and in the Education Building auditorium, where we had pretty much full capability, where at a console the instructor could control computer projections and sound equipment, and all of that was sort of integrated, and began to get people, you know, using that in the classroom. We also organized a lot of training for faculty, used a program that IBM had at the time down the Research Triangle in North Carolina, and we flew, I don't know, any number of faculty down there for rather intensive workshops that IBM was putting on. And I, we, in that process, you know, did create a lot of interest and got the ball rolling. And ultimately then a director of instructional technology, a full-time professional who did know something about the technical stuff, was appointed, and I moved on back to the department. Sort of as a side to that story, I was also involved first in just as a member of a committee where we were developing an improved or new telephone system for the university. But in the process of doing that, we persuaded the folks who were doing all that planning that when we installed the new telephone system, everywhere there was a telephone jack, we put a second jack, which was inexpensive because that process is labor intensive, and they're putting one box in, they could put two. And we also got them to pull a fiber optic loop around the campus at the time, not really knowing what we were going to do with it, but knowing that we ought to be able to do that. And very shortly then we were able to use that fiber optic loop, connect essentially any place on campus that there was a telephone to that system, and we got access to the internet, into the residence halls and everywhere else, and we were very early the folks to do that, and I've always been kind of proud of that, effort, that initiative. And then at the same time was involved, we were paying a great deal of money for cable services into the residence halls. At least I thought it was a great deal of money. And we were, the only cable service, or the cable service we were getting was unlimited to exactly the same service that was being offered to the town by Armstrong. And so we took over the cable service, much to the chagrin of Armstrong Utilities. But we put some satellite dishes up on top of the library, and they're still there. It was really controversial at the time. People were worried about how it would look, and the truth is, once they got up there, people forgot they were there. Yeah. But we developed a cable system then that had considerable savings at the time, and which also was tailor-made, and that we had not only the usual entertainment programming, but we had some modern language, foreign language programming, and expanded CNN stuff, things that would be also useful in the instructional program. And it kind of all came as part of the same package. So that was a significant effort, and that I had a pretty key role in. I was pretty proud of that. So and then most of my work, though, was, of course, with the department. And it's the work I'm proudest of. I came here, I'd stop and count, but I think we had eight members of the department, and we had 30 majors. Only one of them was an arts and science major. The others were all teacher education students. Nothing wrong with that, but that was the nature of the beast. And I think at the high point, I had 21 faculty and 350 majors. Wow. So we went through a period of very significant expansion and changed the nature of the program totally. And in the process, spun off the... first we changed from being a speech and theater department to being a department of communication. And then ultimately spun off the theater program into its own independent program, which it still is. Mm-hmm. And the Department of Communication got into a whole bunch of things that it hadn't been involved with before at all. Into journalism, into electronic stuff. We began a radio station. We just made a lot of developments, I like to think improvements. But hired a lot of faculty. When I was hired, I was fortunate in that, and one of the reasons I took the job is I kind of wanted to do my own thing. And the previous chairman, Dr. Coor, was retiring from the chairmanship. But my first semester here, he was on sabbatical, so I had, relatively free hand, unencumbered by, although he and I had a very good relationship, but there was no awkwardness there. And the administration had anticipated this change, and we had, I think, four faculty members who were on temporary assignments, and those positions were all available. And so I was able to hire rather aggressively that first semester. And we brought Joe Riggs, right, and Tim Walters and Roy Stewart and Mary Martzoff Garfield all came on board that first fall. I came in January, and they all came on board then in the next September, and we rather turned things around at that point. Had new folks and with a common sense of what we were about. So we moved from there. That's kind of a sketch of my university involvement.
What building or buildings have you worked in? What changes did you see them go through?
I've had offices in Eisenberg, which is where our department was housed all those years. I had an office for a time in the education building. I had an office in Old Main and an office in the library. So at various times, I'm kind of a nomad. My home base was always, and my heart was always in the department in Eisenberg. Those were very great changes in that when I was hired, I interviewed in the summer of 1970 to start work in 71 in January. And the department was housed at the time up in the East Gym, and which was in a pretty sad state of repair, and also up there on the corner of the campus. And that was a time when the campus was expanding. Eisenberg was under construction. The library was about to be, and the union was about to be. I mean, all that was sort of coming. And I could see that the center of the campus was going to move down to the lower campus. So one of the things that I sort of insisted on when I was hired was that they move the department into the lower campus. So when I came on board in January is when we moved into Eisenberg. So I never actually worked in East Gym, happily. We did well in Eisenberg. It was a good home for the department. And then, we saw then all that development down there, the The library was built, the union was built, the music building came along, and you know, all that.
Was Vincent already there?
Pardon?
Was Vincent there before Eisenberg?
Yeah, Vincent was there. Yeah, Vincent and the World Culture Building.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure when they were built in the 60s, late 60s, and so they were there and functioning. But Eisenberg was the, and even then it wasn't Eisenberg; it was called ECB2, Classroom Building 2.
Huh.
They later named it, obviously, but it was at that early kind of primitive construction, and there was. The football stadium was there beside the field house, and which is now essentially a kind of an intramural field, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, all that athletic complex that's now there wasn't there. You know, all that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, rather remarkable growth. I look at the campus now and am impressed and pleased and proud. The new AST building is just magnificent, I think, and. I'm glad that they're doing something about Vincent. I mean, it's past time. And it's hard to believe, but, you know, Eisenberg and Weissenfuhr are now practically 40 years old. They're getting on. But a lot of changes. Lots and lots of changes physically and lots of other ways. Yeah.
What was your first impression of the campus when you got here, since you came from out of state?
Yeah. I don't have much of a memory of that, frankly. Partly because, well, I flew in for an interview, and it was not a hurried job, but you know, just a day or two. Didn't see much of it, or much of anything really. And then I came back and looked for a house, and housing was very contrast to today. Houses were almost non-existent. They were able to show me three houses in all of the town to buy, and we bought one over on Oak Street. But it was very limited, but I kind of nipped in and nipped out for that. So I don't know. I don't have much of a recollection of the first impression. Not impressive, frankly. Roy Stewart likes to tell a story when he came from his interview. I picked him up at the airport, and we came to town, and we were going to stop in what is now the Camelot, the restaurant there. And as we turned on the main street, he said to himself, "Ain't no way," because it actually looks pretty good now, but it was kind of dismal at the time.
Yeah.
And but you know, we all sort of overcame that and became very fond of this place. It was a great place to live, a great place to raise family, and my family prospered here as well as did my colleagues. You know, we had a good thing, and I've been quite involved with the town in several ways too. We might want to talk about that before we finish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead and talk about that. How are you involved with the town?
Well, I was asked back in the mid-90s, early 90s, to assume leadership of a group we called Slippery Rock Development. And I was the executive director of Slippery Rock Development for a time. And the story seems almost quaint now because we see so much building around here, housing developments, Arrowhead, and I don't even know the names of all of them anymore. But at the time, the town was just not moving very much. And so we, there were a group of businessmen or local interested people who organized this group, Slippery Rock Development. And we got some support from the county, from county commissioners and one thing and another. And for example, one of our first, our early activities was we organized a Slippery Rock Day for builders. And we went hat in hand to builders in Western Pennsylvania and said, "Come up and look at us." And we had a lunch, and we hired some buses, and we took them around and literally pointed at pieces of land and said, "Here, you can build here. You know, this will be done here." And well, so much of it, you know, has now happened.
Yeah.
In the last 15 years, it's just remarkable to see the changes. After I was involved, Slippery Rock Development sort of morphed into its current version, which has got the grant to redo Main Street and mm-hmm. so forth, and that's been a big thing. We did other things. For example, I think they now call it the Happy Bus, the bus that does a circuit of town, was a project of Slippery Rock Development and of student government.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a grant from the county commissioners originally to support that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how that got started. And, so we had our finger in a number of little pies like that around town and kind of raised awareness of the town. And along in that same period, I chaired a Blue Ribbon Commission for the committee for the school board to study the probable impact of population growth in this area, because they were concerned for school planning. And at the time, became convinced, I remember reporting to them that we looked at a lot of data and studies and information that was available. We really couldn't say just when or how many, but it was clear they were coming, that the population was moving this way out of Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And that's proved to be true. There are a lot of people here now. We're already seeing the impact of that. It's becoming somewhat a bedroom community. I mean, they're mm-hmm. in addition to the university, but there are a lot of people who live around here who don't work here but are working in Pittsburgh. Or, I used to have a neighbor who was a salesman. He lived here because of its access to the airport. Well, I always thought of the airport as a long way off, but you think about it, if you were a salesman, you were in and out once a week. It's a pretty easy drive, and he had good schools and a quiet life and so forth, you know, attractive, so it made sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, I involved in that, and then I've also, my other big community, well, two other involvements. I've been very active in Rotary International. I was district governor in 91-92, and then had a responsibility in Rotary called a Rotary Regional Foundation Coordinator, where I had a relationship with Rotary clubs from Pittsburgh to Omaha, up across the upper Midwest, and that was an interesting kind of time and an effort. And then I also, in my spare time, spent 8 years as pastor of the branch of the United Methodist Church.
Oh, how about that?
So I've kept busy.
That sounds like it.
Who are some of the leaders that you saw pass through the university?
Pass through is a good word. Well, when I got here, the president was a guy named Al Wattrell. And Al, about a year or two later, I don't know, was fired in a rather ugly, unfortunate, in my opinion. I thought he was badly used. I never thought of Al as being a great college president, but if they were going to relieve him, there were better ways than just having the state police appear at his door one day and demand his keys, which is literally what happened. And that firing was engineered, I thought, and a lot of people around here believed, by some of the administrative staff here, and particularly, I don't want to lie on the guy, but it was certainly a common belief, and was my belief, that Jim Roberts, who was the vice president, engineered that termination. And in what I thought, again, was a very unfortunate thing, the state then appointed Roberts as the acting president. And he was clearly a candidate for president. And you put all that together as somebody who was involved in the termination, who had aspirations. And so it was not a real healthy situation. And the campus spent a year in serious, serious turmoil. It was a very ugly time here. A lot of suspicion, a lot of division, a lot of very questionable practices and in faculty procedures and so forth, a lot of enmity, people choosing up sides. In fact, it's probably dissipating now, but right through the end of my time here, if you knew, you could still feel some of the currents of those years of who was on what side and so forth. Well, finally, after a year of agitation, and I frankly was part of the agitation, the Secretary of Education decided rather dramatically and at the very last minute to replace Dr. Roberts with Larry Park. And Larry was the president at Mansfield and had some interest in, it had a grant or a study time looking at troubled presidencies. And so Larry came as interim president. He was very careful to say he was not an acting president, he was the president. But his agreement was he would come for 2 years and 2 years only. And that was a good time for the university. Larry was very savvy. He was a very experienced president. I can still see him. He was a tall man, and I can see him kind of push back from his desk in his office and sort of said, "Well, you know, I've seen that. We've been there. We're not going to get rattled about this one, and move on." And he asked me to, kind of a funny story in a way, he called me in one day and asked me, told me that he wanted me to be a director of planning. And I said, "I don't know anything about planning." He said, "Well, you can learn." But the point was that there was all of this division on the campus and all of this negativity, and he wanted to do some things that would turn energies in positive directions. So we did. We developed a planning system, and one of which I'm still very proud. It was a very good planning system. We got a lot of things started. It was a campus-wide effort, and you know, I think did contribute to an improved environment. Then we had Herb Reinhart for a while as president. And then he was replaced finally by Bob Ebersole, and ultimately by Warren Smith, and now by Bob Smith. And I've had pretty good relationships with all those people. The vice presidency, was held for a number of years by Chuck Faust, and he and I had a curious kind of on-off relationship and sometimes, but ultimately a good one. And I have a lot of warmth in my heart for Chuck. He would often, I think, be suspicious of what I was up to, but he often supported it, you know, in a number of ways. And I appreciated the support I got for some of my schemes. We generated a department chairs organization at the time, and did some retreats for department chairs. I've always been interested in the chairmanship as a key linchpin in the way universities work. And he was a little nervous about the department chairs going off, but he supported it and put his money, or the university's money, into it, and it was a good thing. And of course, he was succeeded by Bob Ebersole. Bob, you know, was on the faculty when I got here as in the physical education department, so I sort of always known Bob, and we got along fine. Knew Warren Smith less well. I've learned to know him well now, largely through our associations together in Rotary. And Bob Smith and I have been professional friends for maybe 40 years. Known each other forever, it seems like, professionally.
So
I was glad to see when he came here.
Where did you know him before here?
Well, we were in our early days both involved in college debate coaching and that business. And we crossed paths sort of, not at the same time, we were never contemporaries, but at Ohio University. And we were both involved in a professional organization called the Association of Communication Administrators. And then the what was then called the Speech Communication Association, you know, professional organizations of one sort. And like I say, I never had worked with him before, but I'd known him and worked sort of around him and in professional relationships for, like I say, 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Who are some of the people that were most influential to you while you were here?
Well, I suppose I really ought to mention Al Schmittlein, who was the dean of what was then the College of Humanities, and well, originally it was the College of Liberal Arts. Mm-hmm. And right after I got here, they broke up the College of Liberal Arts into three parts, and we had the College of Humanities and Fine Arts, and Al was our dean. Mm-hmm. Al was a good guy, and gave a lot of support to some of the things we were up to. I guess Al, Chuck Faust, was an important player in what I was doing. Well, other people too. Lots of people, of course. I was involved in ABSCUF I was the grievance chairman in its very early years, which was a kind of a gnarly assignment because in the nature of things, as the union came into place, there was a lot of tension between management and the union. They were kind of negotiating and trying to feel out each other's power. And so we were in confrontation a lot early. And most of that, of course, those early battles were fought and won and lost and dissipated. But I was involved with that and in cahoots a good bit of that time with Wilma Cattle. Who remains, you know, a dear friend. We were involved quite a lot with ABSCUF kinds of things, both locally, and I was the for a while the parliamentarian of the state ABSCUF organization, and so I was involved in ABSCUF on a wider scale, and that Educational Services Trust thing I talked about also connected with. Mm-hmm. With ABSCUF, so that was important. I was also involved with the football program for a while. I was president of the football boosters club, I guess you'd call it. And I got a athletic blanket that they awarded me when I left that presidency, which I'm proud of.
The university had a boosters club?
Yeah. When Bob DiSpirito was back in his first go-around as coach.
He talked about the partnership with Texas University, and they would send each other their booster clubs to support each other. And so Slippery Rock would be down in Texas, and Texas would be up
there. Those were good times. You know, I still admire the football program. I was just not involved with it. But in those days, I was always proud of our football program. I was never an athlete myself, really, but it always seemed to me that Bob and his staff had a right balance. They cared about their kids. They were very good at what they did. That is, there was excellence in that program, but they didn't sell out. And they were very competitive, even though they didn't have the resources that some of their competition. And they still have that problem. But, we were champions of the conference a couple of times in those years. And it was a good outfit. And I was always proud to be a part of it. And I always thought it was important to link up the athletic program with the academic program. And I saw myself as sort of doing that, in a sense, you know, at least being symbolically so.
Neat. What are some memories you have of the university? Any events that really come to mind?
I don't know, other than the kinds of things we've already talked about. You know, so, I don't know about any specific events other than those kinds of things. There was plenty of, in my early years here, it was a lot of turmoil, frankly, and memories of that time are marked by much of that. Place is a good bit more peaceful than it used to be, I think, more congenial and more we've gotten through a lot of that. The advent of faculty union was an important development, which I opposed originally. I was a little nervous about the whole notion of unionism for faculties. Mm-hmm. I was persuaded at the time by the argument that all other groups that were at the public trough, that is, state troopers and liquor boards, scarps, and so forth, had access to the legislature, were going to be doing it through unions. And if we didn't have the same kind of organization, we'd lose out. So I went along. And I think APSCUF developed in very, very healthy ways. The guy who was the original executive director of APSCUF, a guy named Marty Morand, who came to us in a rather peculiar way. He was working for the NEA, I guess, at the time, and before that had been an organizer for the ILGWU. But Marty is a very, very bright man, very, very bright. And he had this notion that there was a possibility in a faculty union of some grander version of the labor movement, and that faculty were smarter and more sophisticated and would develop a kind of unionism that was different from industrial unionism. And he had this all worked out in terms of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I don't know if you know that, but as your basic needs were met, and then move on up, and finally would get to the point where we were operating at a very high professional and ethical plane. And he sold that. He sold it to the faculty initially, and he sold it in the negotiations, the early contracts. Our first contract was very generous in terms of raising faculty salaries. At first year, we got raises, I don't know, three or four different times at stage through the year. You couldn't ever know how much money you were making because you kept making more. It was kind of neat. But the idea was that if the notion that he sold was that if you rewarded faculty and met their demands or their needs, then they would be more enlightened and go on to higher planes. I think he ultimately was a little disillusioned by that. He found out that faculty were just as grubby and greedy at times as were his garment workers union. But at the same time, APSCUF was a very good thing for most of the first several years, first 10 years, I guess, more or less. That was before the system became a system. And APSCUF was really the only single voice for the system. Before that, there were 14 campuses. Each president was kind of a duke of his own little world. They were in competition. It was kind of strange. It was part of that Educational Services Trust thing, for example. I went around and met with every president in the system. And I used to say, I think it was only one or three people in the world who had been on all 14 campuses. Yeah. There was just no connection, and it was all kind of a mess. But the union became the voice, in a sense, or a voice for the whole system, because it was a contract that covered the whole system and kind of turned the world of higher education in Pennsylvania, I think, in some significant ways. So it only became a very, very good thing, I think, and has worked out to be a very, very healthy relationship. And it's like any such relationship. I suppose it has its moments, but on balance, it's a good thing. I'm convinced of that today.
What happened during the investigation of the bookstore in 1975? Do you remember that?
Gee, I'd forgotten about that. I really have forgotten about it. And we did discover that there were apparently irregularities in the bookstore, and called attention to that, and finally the guy who was running the bookstore was run off, in effect, and fired. I really don't remember enough of the detail reported. I do know, I would confess now that I was right in the middle of it. It wasn't very difficult to figure out. I mean, when you looked at what was going on and you kind of looked at their books and so forth, it was clear that something was amiss. Hmm. And that was sort of the ultimate conclusion. Hmm. Where'd you find out about that?
The Rocket.
The Rocket, okay.
Mm-hmm. Reading old Rockets to prepare for
I'd forgotten about that altogether. Yeah.
Wasn't there another something that you found in there?
I was just wondering
some other dirt.
I was just wondering how the hiring freeze in 1977 specifically affected Slippery Rock.
Oh, I don't remember that it did all that much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it inconvenienced us some, but I don't think it had that big a deal. Those are kind of little bumps in the road that kind of wear themselves out, you know. Mm-hmm. And they're frankly, even with hiring freezes, there are ways to wire around it, and there were then, you know, through temporary positions and shifting stuff. And I don't remember that. We complained a lot. I don't remember we suffered all that much. I used to complain constantly about the what was for many years the propensity of in a growing department with a heavy demand for teaching a general studies course, a public speaking course. I mean, we had a cross, you know, a rather substantial obligation there that we needed faculty, and they kept assigning faculty temporary positions. You know, I couldn't hire permanent positions, and that's just not a good way to run a department. Tim Waters and I went through an exercise a couple of years ago trying to make a list of all the people who worked in the department over the years, and it was a very, very long list. Yeah. And we even had a little trouble remembering all those people because, you know, that kind of revolving door. But happily, we had a good core who did stick with us. So that all worked out. But I don't remember the hiring freeze itself really was that big a deal for us, maybe. Mm-hmm.
What do you miss about being at Slippery Rock University?
Oh, I miss the collegiality of the people. You know? Mm-hmm. I used to had a lot of friends on the campus, in a lot of places, not just in my own department. And I miss all those people. I don't see them very often. And mm-hmm. it's kind of, you know, I'm always a little amazed. I get what they not call rock pride, I guess. And of course, I've been out of here now 11 years since I retired. Mm-hmm. I almost never recognize a name anymore. And you think about it, well, what happens to a faculty of, 400 in rough numbers? Probably 50 or so of those are temporary at any one time, so they come and go. And then you retire anywhere between 10 and 30 people a year over a 10-year period.
Right. That's the whole thing.
Pretty close to total turnover, not quite, you know. There are the Wilma Cattles in the world that be forever, but you know, most of the people I worked with are gone, you know. And even in the department, there's still a few people there that I hired, I don't know, half the people down there anymore. I try to maintain a relationship with them. I continue to sponsor an annual lecture on freedom of speech, underwrite that, which kind of keeps me in some very tenuous connection with the department. I've always believed it was not my job to go down and try to run a department after I'd graduated, so to speak. But You know, I miss the people, and I miss the students. I have a good relationship over years with a lot of students, and that's what keeps you going in this business for the most part. Yeah.
Do you have any words of wisdom for us? Anything you want any current or future rock students or community members to know?
Well, I think the thing that I always thought I knew about Slippery Rock and tried to convince students particularly is that how good this place is. There was a time, I'd like to think we've gotten beyond it, but I don't really know because I'm not in touch with students so much anymore. But there was a time when kids would come here with sort of, well, what the hell with Slippery Rock? You know, I'm here because I didn't go to Harvard or to Penn State or someplace else. And they would see it as kind of a second choice. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was a very great mistake. And then we would have students, and we used to have a very energetic effort in the department. I'm not sure it still exists, but Joe Riggs used to kind of head it up for us of encouraging the kids to go to graduate school. And we placed a lot of students in major doctoral programs. We were producing a PhD or more a year for a while, and sending them off to the Big Ten and places like that. And they were being very, very competitive. And I remember clearly counseling with kids who would say, oh, I can't do that because I'm from Slippery Rock. And I would say, Slippery Rock kids can make it anywhere, and they do. And like I say, we send our kids off to the University of Illinois or to Purdue or someplace like that, and they would succeed because our preparation was good and their quality was good, and it's important that they recognize it. I used to describe it as a kind of a donut effect, that Slippery Rock's reputation, if you got out 75 miles, was pretty good, but the hometown effect was everybody was sort of familiarity, I guess, bred and content. But I think a lot of that attitude has changed. At least I'd like to think it has. And there are a lot of things about the university now, just physically, and it's attractive, and programmatically, a lot of things are going on. And if a student looks around them, they got to be impressed. They still suffer from, it's typical, I suppose, of a regional university of too many people clear out on the weekends and that kind of thing. They would do much better if they would stay and invest themselves. And those who do very well, and are enriched by all that. So it's Booker T. Washington. I'm going to give you a little speech lesson here now.
Okay.
Booker T. Washington made a speech to what was called the Atlanta Exposition. And it was an attempt to kind of launch the post-war, post-Civil War South, kind of the New South. And he was speaking there about the role of blacks in the New South. And this is a 100-year-old story now, more than that. But, and you got to put it in that context, but he was trying to encourage black populations to put down roots and to take advantage of their opportunities, is kind of what they wanted to. And he told his story about this ship that was adrift and was without water and was in rather dire straits, a sailing ship. And they were really desperate. And finally, another sail appeared on the horizon, and they messaged to it, that we die of thirst. And the message that came back was, cast down your bucket where you are. And they thought, that's crazy. And so they repeated this, and the story goes on, I think, three different times. And so finally, the third time, they did that. They thought, well, what the heck? And discovered that they had drifted into the mouth of the Amazon, and the water underneath them was pure, was sweet, it was not salty. And so the message was, cast down your bucket where you are, take advantage of the opportunity, you know, kind of bloom where you planted. And I think that's a good lesson for Slippery Rock people. There's a lot of opportunity here. Mm-hmm. The heritage of this place is rich, and the heritage of this area is rich. I'm not a Western Pennsylvanian by birth, but I've come to appreciate it. And good people come out of these small towns in Western Pennsylvania. And I've even known one or two good people came out of Pittsburgh, you know. But there's a lot of opportunity here, and the university, I think, is just growing in the stature, not necessarily numbers. I understand the size control, which probably is a good thing, as a matter of fact. It's big enough, and, you know, it doesn't need to get bigger faster, because there's certainly been enough resource problems without outstripping them. But and we went through a period where we tried to grow when we shouldn't have. You know, there was a time when there was this ambition to have 10,000 students. This was back in the early 70s, and it was crazy. And we were admitting people, recruiting kids that couldn't read and write, literally. And the quality of students has gotten much better, and that's good.
Definitely.
But it's a good place. I used to enjoy recruiting faculty for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is I always thought it was an honest effort. I could say to the people with a straight face, you know, this is a good place to be. There are good people here. It's a good working environment in terms of all the nickel and dime stuff. And some of it's not nickel and dime, with fringe benefits and all the kind of stuff that go with it. But more than that, you know, it's just it's a civilized place by and large. Good place. So enjoy Slippery Rock. You know, it's important.
Well, I don't think I have any questions. Judy, do you have any other questions for him?
No, I don't.
Just told you more than I know.
Well, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to interview and allowing Judy to be here.
Well, I enjoy
it. So thank you again.
I'll enjoy remembering, you know.
Yeah.